Picture this. You're halfway through a DIY car fix, tools scattered everywhere, and boom, you realize you're missing a part. It's okay, because you know whatever it is, it's on eBay. They've got everything. Brakes, headlights, cold air intakes, whatever you need. And it's guaranteed to fit, which means no more crossing your fingers and hoping you ordered the right thing. All the parts you need, at prices you'll love. Guaranteed to fit, every time. eBay. Things. People. Love.
Hello and welcome to F1 Explains. This is the official Formula One podcast that exists to explain the sports we all love. My name is Christian Hugill. Alongside me, as ever, is Katie Osborne.
Hi, Christian. Glad to be here with you. And this is the Quickfire Special. And if you're just joining us for the first time on F1 Explains, thank you for joining us. Quickfire means we have two wonderful guests who join us for questions that maybe aren't a full episode long, but are rapid fire, and we get some really great insights. And often one question leads to another answer to leads to another question answer session. So it really just kind of tumbleweeds into something really wonderful and great. This week we have two guests that we're on team radio. You hear lots of talk about plan B, C, and D. Well, our two guests this week were definitely our plan A. Oh, I love that. Yes, they were. We have Ruth Wiscum and Bernie Collins. Welcome back. This is a joy to have you on this Quickfire episode.
What an intro.
What an intro.
Well, I don't think this person will mind me saying this, but we shouldn't take for granted that it's plan A, because when we recorded the first Quickfire special of the 2024 season, Bernie Collins was unfortunately poorly. She was on the lineup, so we roped in Jolyon Palmer. So Jolyon was plan B. Jolyon was aware of this. He wouldn't mind us saying this. Jolyon, someone on the podcast a lot, are good friends of ours. But we do have plan A this time. And if ever Jolyon Palmer appears in the future, you'll know Jolyon's plan B.
Aww. I still feel guilty about that.
Jolyon wouldn't mind me saying that. We love Jolyon Palmer. Both Bernie and Ruth, of course, are F1 race-winning strategists. It's lovely to have them both back on the podcast. So what do we do when we get people in Formula One on the podcast? We ask them about when their jobs go wrong. Our first question this week is about when strategy goes wrong. Now, John, who's written this email, has written it in a way I can't pull off. Katie, do you want to have a go?
You can do it.
You want me to have a go? I'll try, but hang on, let me have a go. John in America.
Go a little.
America.
Go a little. Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Ruth.
America.
Yes. Yeah, girl. Yeah.
America.
Nah, man. America.
America.
America. Yes.
America.
Ruth.
John in America.
Excellent.
Are we going Valley Girl, or are we going to go like, okay, John in America.
Yeah. Yes.
I thought I'd go to the resident American on the podcast, but it turns out Ruth Buscombe can do it just as well. Nailed it, Ruth. John's question's very blunt, but I do enjoy it. How do teams mess up their strategies if the strategists and the race engineers are talking? So in other words, how and why do race strategies go wrong? This feels like a sort of when nightmares happen question. Bernie, how and why can it occasionally go wrong?
I was going to say it never happened to me, so I've got no idea. That would be totally factually incorrect. You know, there's loads of reasons it goes wrong. Sometimes it can be really simple things, like actually you might have chosen quite a good stop lap, but the next lap there's a safety car deployed and therefore the strategy that you chose at that time was incorrect. Sometimes it can be because you are trying to second guess reactions of others and then they react in a slightly different way. So we sometimes see leaders pit into traffic and the traffic pits the next lap. But if the traffic doesn't pit, then suddenly you're caught in traffic. So there's loads of things, or, you know, the comms about how the tyres are operating isn't quite correct. And you figure out later on the tyres could have gone for 10 more laps. And we're trying to limit comms to the driver. And actually, the driver has the most information about how the car is currently doing, how the tyres feel, whether he wants to stop early or late. So the things that you find most often that have gone wrong are the driver complaining that the strategy is not what he expected. And there are loads of little examples of where things can go wrong. But you see it quite regularly, and hopefully race on race we learn from it and do better the next week.
Yeah, those mistakes are made and then you redirect and you learn from them, right? And I think as a driver, as a strategist, as a TV commentator or a broadcaster or whatnot, I mean, we all have been there. And yeah, but it can go wrong, right? And all of a sudden you're on a platform and next thing you know, oops, you know, Ruth, has it, have you experienced any such, or are you on Bernie's team, where just hopefully it's never happened?
Yeah, I think everything that Bernie said is correct there. And I think as a strategist, it is really important to embrace failure. It is in any sports. Like if you look at any kind of Hall of Famer or anyone that's ever achieved anything in sports, no one's got 100% perfect record. And it's about trying to be as the most consistent. And a lot of that is pulling on the strings of failure and being open and talking about your failures, which actually, all that really means is, you know, there's only 10 teams nowadays in Formula One. So like, even if you were the second best team on the day, you could have got pipped and lost the race win to another team that did, you know, a better job than you. And as Bernie mentioned, there's lots of different ways. Normally it comes down to either, you know, you did a risk versus reward that maybe didn't turn out right that day, but on average, maybe the thing that you need to achieve across a championship, it may be like a parameter that was slightly wrong, which is how the tires are, how fast you are, how good you are at overtaking, how good or bad somebody else's tires are. So there's loads of different ways. And what's important is to not really, as a strategist, judge on results, but judge on decision making. So Bernie gave a great example there of like, you could actually have pitted at a really good time and then a safety car comes out the next lap. Now, if you do that across a season, on average, you'll end up with a better result. So you should reframe that in your brain as being, actually, I made a good decision, but you know, on this occasion, it didn't work out. And it can also go the other way around. Like you can make a really bad strategic like decision, and then you get saved by something else. And it's equally important to turn around and go, you know, normally when people are congratulating you, so it's a bit awkward, but you're like, actually, I did a terrible job there. Like, I shouldn't have been on that tire choice. You know, the safety car saved me, or I shouldn't have been there. Like, I pitted and then I got really lucky. And really reframing success and failure both as kind of almost similar imposters. And that actually it's all about decision making and learning from it. And as Bernie says, improving your tools, your skills as a strategist and your communication, to try to be the best version of you and to put the best kind of package together as you grow.
Bernie, you told me a great story about this once from the race you won, Sergio Perez in Bahrain.
I can't believe I was talking about that race.
I couldn't believe it either. You don't talk about it, Bernie, do you?
Never talk about the race.
Obviously, Sergio won that race. Phenomenal result for him. But a lot of F1 fans were heartbroken because it went so wrong for George Russell. He was covering for Lewis Hamilton that race when Lewis was off with COVID. And if my memory serves me correctly, didn't a certain senior figure at Mercedes ask you, Bernie, after the race, whether if you were in their shoes, you'd have made the strategic call that they did?
Yeah, so exactly. You know, we in that race, we made some good decisions earlier on, but we were on course for P3 in that race, which still, you know, would have been a fantastic result for racing point. But the two Mercedes were both ahead. George Russell has stood in for Lewis. They both did their pit stop. They had a terrible pit stop. You know, anyone that remembers it, they had the wrong tyres out. It was, you know, a bit of a nightmare.
Live pictures of George Russell coming in. Old hard tyres coming off. Bottas having to double stack.
They're going to double stack, and it was a slow pit stop as well for Russell. I think he's gone out on the medium. I think they're going to put the medium tyre on both cars. Very slow stop for Valtteri Bottas. And he's not ready on the left-hand front.
This could be handing the victory to George Russell. They're still struggling with Bottas.
And they put the hard tyres back on the car, Alex.
What is going on? Could this be handing victory to George Russell?
George Russell now with a commanding lead of this Grand Prix, surely.
Okay, George, we're going to need to box. We have a mixed tyre set on the car.
No!
That's the problem. They put half of Valtteri's set on George.
Oh, what a phenomenal drive being undone by a moment which brings George Russell back to the pits. He would get the penalty anyway. And listen to this, because it's really happening. It's genuinely true. Sergio Perez spun round at turn four on lap one, leads in Sakhir.
Because of their terrible pit stops, we won the race because it took both Mercedes' car effectively out of the running. And that night, during some of the celebrations, Toto asked if I would have made the same decision. And as a strategist, it was 100% the correct decision for Mercedes to do at that point, to take that pit stop, because they had a free pit window. They can't be responsible for a pit stop going wrong. Now, you can look back at it and say, if they hadn't done the pit stop, they would have won the race, 1-2, easy. But you have to make decisions with the information you have at the time. and then go back and look at them. So like Ruth's point of analysing the decisions, not necessarily the result, is exactly what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. And I'm blown away too. It, you know, long time ago now, it feels like Bernie, we were having the conversation about how teams are often now treated like athletes, from the driver to the pit crew to the you guys on the wall. And just another example as to why you guys have to be sharp, both mentally, emotionally, physically, to be able to say, hey, ego dropped, I'm learning and growing. And, you know, that's such it's such a mental and emotional health game as well. And being able to put you guys in a position that you guys have to be on in that regard, I think it highlights how you guys are, you know, in a sense, athletes as well in your own craft. Yeah, that's right. That's right, Ruth. I love that little strong arm. Yes.
Yeah, Ruth gave a little strong arm to the camera there. We love that. F1 Explained at F1.com is the place to send us an email to ask your question. We do love an email, but we even more than an email love a voice note.
Hi, Katie and Christian. It's Dara here from Ireland. I've been an F1 fan for a couple of years now, but one thing I constantly struggled with getting my head around is the upgrades to cars that come out throughout the season. So I think we constantly hear every couple of races that a certain team or certain teams have an upgrade package coming, and how will it change the performance of the car? And I just wanted to know if there's a limit to the amount of upgrades a team can produce throughout the year. I know the cost cap probably has some influence on that, but if there's certain things that aren't allowed to be upgraded, certain things that can be upgraded, and if there's a difference between, let's say, during the race season or outside of the race season. Thanks so much, and I'm a big fan of the podcast.
Last time Bernie and Ruth were on this podcast, a listener said to us that Bernie's accent must be worth 0.2 seconds. Dara's must be worth at least that much. What a lovely accent that was. I was distracted by the accent, wasn't fully listening to the question. Bernie, were you listening any better than me, please?
Oh, yes, I'm always listening, Christian.
Action.
Yeah, so the question is around car upgrades. Teams will decide sometimes at the start of the year what their schedule of car upgrades are, depending on what the upgrade is. So you might get, for example, a new front wing. But if you put the new front wing on the old car, it's actually not a benefit. You need to put it on with some other components, which is why sometimes teams bring upgrades as packages, big packages that they wait a few races to come. But sometimes, you know, the front wing will work with either of the side pods or whatever behind it. So you can just put it on as soon as you get it. So it's very dependent on the upgrade and a little bit on the team, whether they want to do it in sort of these bulks or little bits. And often you find teams that are at the slower end of the scale are just going to bring upgrades as soon as they're available because they want to get more running on it. They want to get more testing on it. So even though it might not be the perfect full upgrade, if it brings any little bit, it's worth it to them. So a lot of difference. There's no difference really between in-season and, you know, out-of-season upgrades, except that obviously out-of-season you're doing a much bigger package for the first winter test. Especially if there's no change in regulations, you know, that this, you can put an upgrade on literally the last race and you've got some running on that idea before you get to the next season.
If you were to do something like that, that would be in a sense for the next season, right? Or is it, could that upgrade there for that tail end? I mean, that's for that race. You can come through for the last of the season just to kind of make a final push.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, even if you learn that the upgrade's not any good, that's still good learning for your wind tunnel. It's still good correlation for any of your simulation models. So that's why we tend to see teams. And the reason, you know, that we sometimes see upgrades in Friday that don't necessarily run in the race weekend is on-track running is, well, the most expensive way to test an upgrade, but it's your most reliable data. So you can correlate what's happening in your wind tunnel. And that's really important going into the winter season before you do all your work for next year's car.
And Ruth, I'm also guessing that F1's modern lack of in-season testing has some sort of impact as well. Back in the old days, you could do pretty much unlimited testing. You could rip the car up and start again, but you can't really do that, A, now because of the cost cap, and B, because of the lack of testing. That must limit it in some way.
Yeah, I think the predominant factor for most teams is that cost cap, because it varies team on team, but typically they'll probably set aside something in the order of 10 to 15 million, let's say, that they're going to spend on upgrades, that they've got that kind of penciled in. As Bernie says, they'd normally start with an original plan. And then depending on where your car is weak and strong, what kind of upgrades you're seeing in terms of numbers through your simulations or through your wind tunnel hours. And genuinely nowadays, how many crashes you've had, because if a crash costs you £1 million and you do three of those that you weren't expecting, you might need to be factoring that into your overall plan for the season. You will decide how to manufacture them. And exactly as Bernie says, you can have fit and forget style upgrades, which you just put them on. You almost don't even, you know, do it like a specific test for them. You just kind of put that part on. And as Bernie says, you kind of roll with it, or you'll have packages of elements that are specifically designed to work together. In terms of the question that we had, in terms of, is there anything you cannot change? No, by regulation, but yes, nowadays by kind of financial constraints. So there's certain things that are very, very expensive and not really worth the bang for your buck in terms of a performance. So nowadays, if people will really try to carry around really expensive things like gearboxes, whereas before there'd be quite a lot of like either in-season development or cross-season development, because, you know, if you had the money, you could spend it. And obviously the bigger teams had that money. Nowadays, the kind of performance that you get from doing that is not really worth it compared to an aero one. So we've seen a different kind of shape of the kinds of upgrades that we get. And then just as Bernie says, for a kind of these evolution years, so 23 into 24, 24 into 25, is kind of an evolution of regulations. And the one test that we do have is this post-season test in Abu Dhabi. And one of the rules is you're only allowed to run parts that you've run in a previous race. So that's why you'll often see teams bring some kind of new concept for the last race, mostly so they can then run it for 2 days with a bunch of extra instrumentation or on two cars in the post-season test. And then when we get to 2026, it's even more exciting because at the moment there's a rule, so no one can start on their 2026 car until the 1st of January next year is what the current date in terms of the aero development. And that means that next year, in terms of your upgrade budget, teams are going to have to decide, because there's a lot less crossover between what you learn in these revolution years that will help you across it, what kind of percentage of your effort, time and money and your cost cap allowance you want to spend on this year's car versus next year's car. And a lot of that will, as Bernie says, you'll have an original plan. And then if you're either really far ahead of everybody or really far behind, you might need to adjust that based on what you do to try to maximize your result as a team. And this is what our kind of very clever technical directors and heads of aero are all deciding. And then us, the strategists, we just get what we're given on race day usually.
And navigate from there. And as you were mentioning, January of next year, that happens to be 2025. A couple of fun facts on the big picture of upgrades. Power unit regulations are frozen until 2026. Teams cannot make upgrades, but they can make changes to improve reliability. Gearbox upgrades are limited as well at this time. Teams are only allowed to make one gearbox upgrade between 2022 and 2026, which is pretty wild to me. I think that that's an interesting fun fact, because so much can happen between 2022 and 2026. Other than that, they can make changes to improve reliability. Also, as long as upgrades don't breach the overall design regulations, the only thing that, as you were mentioning, the only thing limiting upgrades is time and money, which can be very limiting in an F1 season, both the time and the money.
We've got an email next from Alyssa. Alyssa says, love the podcast. At this point, I've listened to every episode at least twice, I think. I mean, that's very kind of you, Alyssa. I don't think I've listened to every episode twice and I present it.
But Alyssa has.
Yeah.
Thank you, Alyssa.
I've really enjoyed learning about F1 strategy from Bernie Collins, Alyssa says, and her wealth of knowledge. I understand that the majority of F1 strategists are engineers. I wondered if there was any other educational background beside engineering that would allow one to potentially become an F1 strategist. Also, hello to Claudio in Windermere, Florida, who also asked about pursuing a career in F1 engineering. Bernie, as you were referenced by one of your adoring public, would you like to go first on this one?
Well, first of all, that is very kind. Thank you. I think maybe I've led people astray here, because I am a mechanical engineer, but I think the majority of F1 strategists are not actually engineers. Did you study engineering, Ruth, or did you study mathematics? Engineering. So there's quite a few that are engineers, but there's also quite a few that have studied pure mathematics, because actually a lot of what you do on the pit wall in terms of the strategy models that we run, the decisions that we make, some of it's statistics based, some of it is like software based. So a lot there, you get quite a few engineers, quite a few strategists that are actually done mathematics degrees or something similar to that. More and more in the junior members of the group, we're seeing people who have done more like a software-based engineering course, because you still do mathematics to a very high level, which is what we use in the pit wall. But, you know, more and more of the software and the coding has become more important to the decisions that we make quickly. And ultimately, I think, and, you know, happy for Ruth's opinion on this, I think the key elements that you need to be a good strategist are making the decisions quickly and communication. They're the two things that we struggle to find in members of the group, is you have to work so quickly with many other people that that's actually a limitation. So engineering is definitely one route, but there are others, you know, mathematics being the main alternative, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree with absolutely everything Bernie says there. I'm a aerospace and aerothermal engineer, and Adrian Newey, I am not. So I have not necessarily used my the direct thing of my degree. So I was a simulation engineer. So I wrote the models for the simulator and then moved into strategy. So I came from a kind of aero engineering background, then did a software related job, and then did strategy. So, and in my time, I've found people from various different backgrounds, also from various different countries. So I've kind of worked with people that have had their degrees in, I think, 7 or 8 different countries now. So there's lots of different options there. It's basically STEM-based subjects. And as Bernie says, having a strong STEM-based degree is kind of your like basic ticket to entry. But there's lots of people that have really great engineering degrees that, as Bernie mentions, the kind of the enjoying the live pressure of decision making is something that is actually quite unique to the strategy role in terms of the way that we apply maths live. Whereas, you know, let's say if you were more focused in kind of aero or design, it's the pressure of working on a project for 9 months, not knowing necessarily if it's going to work. And then you have to kind of actually deploy it, and you don't know if they've spent the last 9 months doing something spectacular or awful. So, you know, it's all stressful. It's just got to pick what's your kind of pressure that you enjoy. And as Bernie says, I think it is making, you know, live decisions and having a good mathematical background. And I know we're both graduates of the Formula Student or FSAE, if you're outside of the United Kingdom, programs, which were great when I was at university for not only kind of networking and meeting people that were already worked in motorsport through alumni through that program, but actually getting to see hands-on kind of how a race car moves together. And, you know, I didn't grow up in an environment where I kind of had the ability to build a car in my back garden in central London. So knowing, yeah, kind of the Formula Student as well would be something that I say that if you are in an area where you can get involved in that in your university or local area with marshalling or something like that, that also helps you really just understand the kind of the environment and the pressure of, you know, and the pain, you know, the pain of losing in a motorsport environment, which is something that really you do need to kind of get your head around before you start to be a strategist, because it's mostly torture. That's a quote by James Allison.
I'm just blown away at how much is performance based in what you guys do. I think, Bernie, you bringing up the fact communication is key. I never would have put two and two together until meeting you, Bernie, and obviously now having a conversation with you, Ruth. It's unbelievable. Of course, you have to have the brains, the smarts, the ability to connect the dots so very much, of course, but then it's under the pressure that you're mentioning, and that's a completely different skill set than someone who maybe works in software regularly, right? Which could come in through an engineer standpoint. So it's so fascinating to learn your guys' background. So I'd say, you know what, we could have a whole episode on just the background of Ruth and Bernie. Christian, Chris, we'll make that another rapid fire later on.
I mean, you say that, my bit would be quite short, Katie. Good Lord. But yeah, fascinating answers from Bernie and Ruth there. Now we're going to go to a little break now, which last time Bernie and Ruth were on the podcast, we sort of accidentally invented a quiz question going into the break. Or a little pause if your podcast provider is lucky enough not to give you breaks. I thought it went down so well. Katie, would you like me to bring the feature back? Would you like another quiz question?
I would love it. I would just give it Christian Chris. Wait, we got to be able to... Christian's quiz.
Christian's quiz. Okay, fine. Good.
Yes.
So back by sort of popular demand, here is Christian's quiz. I tell you what, let's put it to Ruth and Bernie this time. Why not? So Max Verstappen claimed his 100th career podium finish at the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix of 2024. how many other drivers have achieved this feat in F1? No Googling. You've got until the end of this break to work out your answer. Back in a second.
Picture this. You're halfway through a DIY car fix, tools scattered everywhere, and boom, you realize you're missing a part. It's okay, because you know whatever it is, it's on eBay. They've got everything. Brakes, headlights, cold air intakes, whatever you need. And it's guaranteed to fit, which means no more crossing your fingers and hoping you ordered the right thing. All the parts you need, at prices you'll love. Guaranteed to fit, every time. eBay. Things. People. Love.
Welcome back to F1 Explains. Now, a short time ago, we asked you a quiz question in a spontaneous feature, which we've called Christian's Quiz. That quiz question was, Max Verstappen claimed his 100th career podium finish at the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix of 2024. How many other drivers have achieved this feat in F1? Katie, we asked Ruth and Bernie. Would you have known the answer, Katie? I certainly wouldn't have, not off the top of my head.
No, I would have definitely had to Google.
Okay.
For sure.
Bernie Collins?
I don't...
Do you know, or are you having an educated guess?
It's not even an educated guess. It's just a guess.
Entirely an educated guess.
Four others.
Yeah, maybe we go around the horn and Ruth? Give a good old-fashioned guess.
I actually know this.
Go on, Ruth.
So podiums, it's seven, isn't it? Because Senna...
Correct.
Senna only made it to 80. I think Kimi's just over.
So the other six... At the top, Lewis Hamilton with 197, Michael Schumacher 155, Sebastian Vettel 122, Alain Prost 106, Fernando Alonso 106 at the time of recording, Kimi Raikkonen 103, Max Verstappen 101 again at the time of recording. And you are right, of course, the late great Ayrton Senna, who would have undoubtedly added to his tally, finished on 80. Ruth, very impressive.
I'm not a cool person.
I love
not
this. A cool person. No. Oh, so great.
Excellent.
Well done.
Excellent.
It is actually relevant for driver performance because you can actually see when they get close to milestones, some of them really like get overly stressed. It's like a bit of a monkey on the back. So like there was a big thing with kind of, you know, as Lewis was getting up to like taking the record, it was quite like you could actually see his performance get a bit stressed and like... Now he's 197, so let's see if it's like, because if he gets close to the like 200 maybe this year or maybe next year with Ferrari, if he has a similar thing. But no, there is a phenomenon that drivers, either on their first or when they get to a milestone number, that even if they're at the top of their game, they start to do. But I don't think Max even looks at Wikipedia, so I doubt he'll care. So he'll probably just like slide past them without even knowing.
No, Max doesn't care about these sort of records, does he? Well, he says he doesn't. And can I just, before we move on, thank F1.com, who we frequently plug at the end of the podcast due to it being a fantastic new service for Formula One, but also for its good quizzes as well, where I shamelessly stole that quiz question from. Thank you, F1.com. And its special features contributor, Rob Burnett, who I stole that quiz from. Katie, you've got an email.
Yes, an email from Mark in Calgary. You often hear drivers saying in interviews that they were looking after their tires well. What does that mean and how does that affect a driver's race strategy when they need to do that? Ruth.
Yeah, so how a driver looks after their tires, they're not coddling them before the race. It's how much kind of energy they're putting into those tires when they're on track. So teams will have methods based on history and simulation as to, a bit like when we were talking about fuel saving in the previous episode, as to where on track is the most efficient place to save. And by efficient, we mean gaining the most amount of goodness for your tires for the least amount of lap time lost, or doing it in a place where you can't get overtaken. So actually, it depends quite a lot on the number of left versus right-handers. So you'll normally have one tire or one corner of the car that's actually the one that's the most stressed out, and that's going to be your limit. And so the corners that you know on a map before you go into the actual race itself. And then we say looking after, again, it's pretty similar. So it is lifting. So it's lifting before braking normally to put less energy into it, and then controlling things like wheel spin. So instead of kind of coming out of the corner very aggressively, trying to make sure you come out of the corner nice and looking after the tires.
Which you said in a previous episode, sometimes drivers who are a little bit angry, a little bit on the gas, if you will, you see in the stats on the computer when they've come out of the corners, a little bit of feisty.
So most of the time you're doing those things, which just reduce the amount of energy you're putting into a tire. Normally it's one critical corner, and normally there's only like two or three spots, depending on the layout, where that's really worth doing. Other times you might get strange ones where the tire is either too hot or too cold. And so looking after the tire could be something a little bit more about looking for certain kind of conditions on the track. So a great example of that is when it's rainy. Often some parts of your track are nice and dry, but parts of it are too wet to be on a slick tire. And so you'll hear them to say, look after their tires. And that in the pinnacle of motorsport means find some puddles and drive in them, please. So that your tire doesn't overheat on the straight bit. So it survives, because the rubber is a lot softer on those kind of inter tires, until the point that it's physically dried out on other parts. And then very rarely you'll get a time when the tire could be too cold, and kind of looking after the tires is making sure. So if you're being lapped, for example, you have to go offline, you don't pick up any extra rubber or rubbish onto your tire. And sometimes you actually have to push harder to keep the tire in the window. So various different ways, all done by our wonderful tire departments, usually, in terms of how that we do this. And then it is kind of working within the groups of strategy of what we want to do. We're the ones just making trouble for everybody, saying, can you get to like lap, you know, 25, and they're like, are you mad? It's only lap, you know, 7. And then they kind of normally do all the hard work. Bernie?
No, that's 100% agree with all that.
Yeah, we're the ones asking for the miracles.
Wonderful, wonderful work, Ruth Buscombe. Right, f1explained@f1.com is the place to send your emails and voice notes for us to answer. We're always very grateful for every voice note. We say a lot how particularly grateful for voice notes we are. Now, if this is your voice note that you've sent in, please don't think we're any less grateful, but it does come with a slight apology from producer Chris. This wasn't really a voice note. It was a bit more of a voice podcast. So producer Chris says, we're very sorry. We've had to trim this down a little bit, but we're incredibly grateful for it nonetheless.
Hi, Katie and Christian. Love your podcast. Thanks for sharing your wisdom and your F1 connections. You say you love voice notes, so I hope that's true, because this is going to be a long one. My name is Rose. I live in Port Orange, Florida, just 12 minutes away from the Daytona International Speedway. So what's that T-bar that's above and behind the drivers? Is that the camera that gives us the view from in the car? And it also seems to be colored fluorescent yellow for some of the drivers, like Lewis. Does that differentiate the drivers to their teams? My husband has pointed out that sometimes the inner wheel guards are colored to differentiate the team drivers, like on Ferrari. Are there other ways the teams do this too? Thanks for everything, Katie and Christian. I hope I get these answers. You're both the best, and I look forward to every episode upcoming.
Rose in Port Orange, Florida sounds delightful.
Thank you, Rose.
Lovely lady.
Lovely.
One of those people that I think you just want to go for a drink with, Rose, I think.
Right?
She's got a husband.
I appreciate that might have come across that way. That's not the way I meant it. I mean, there are quite a few reasons why that wouldn't work, to be honest with you. But anyway, let's move on. Rose, apologies again that we had to edit that one down from sort of 5-odd minutes, but it's a fantastic question. Oh, and also Maria in Arizona asked us the same question. So thank you to you as well, Maria. Bernie, why don't you shed some light on this for us?
Yeah, so first of all, Kia is always asking for voice notes. So we sort of had that one coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose. Which is good. But yes, exactly. So basically the FIA have an order that they have the teams in, and that order is championship position from the year before. So that's on all their documents as teams within that order. Within each team, the drivers have effectively a driver one and a driver two. And those T-bars are the onboard cameras. So exactly what you see when you're looking at any of the onboard footage is generally from there, unless it's the new helmet cam one. Driver one will have the black camera and driver two will have the fluorescent yellow camera. Teams choose which drivers are which based on a whole variety of metrics. It might be the driver that signed the contract first. It might be the driver that finished better in the position last year. For many years, Lewis was driver one. He was a black camera. And then, I believe, but I've not spoken to Lewis directly, because he wanted the fluorescent to match his helmet and all the other little fluorescent 44s that he runs, he went to driver two. So he chose to be driver two in the team and have the fluorescent yellow roll hoop because it matches his branding for all of his other things. You know, the 44 is fluorescent, and teams can accent the cars in whatever way they want to. in order to show it. But that camera must be on each car and it must be coloured each way. Some people use that explicitly to tell the difference between the cars. I didn't, because, you know, when Lewis changed from being car one to car two, that blew my mind for like the first 3 months of operating the software. Because, for example, in our software, like driver one for each team will be a solid line and driver two will be a dashed line. So even though, you know, Ferrari will be red on both lines, we can tell the difference in which driver, or one will be dots and one will be squares. All these little things that, you know, in our graph, we can tell the difference between the drivers.
That's mind blowing, by the way, just to clarify for anybody who has really been, I saw producer Chris's face just go like, how? Like his eyeballs just was blown away by that. And that's wild.
So like when we're looking at a graph, just by, you know, muscle memory of knowing the color and whether it's solid or dashed, I'll know which driver it is. So the year that Lewis switched, it was like, what is going on? You know, it took ages to get that right. And the same happens with team colours and all these things. But so what I tended to use when I was looking for a driver in a car was their helmet. So their helmet, generally, the drivers are quite distinctive. That has become harder with the halo. So normally it's, if you're trying to see a car coming out, you're the pit lane, you're trying to see which driver it is. Normally not even your cars, because you know if it's your cars. Normally it's if it's a competitor car, it's leaving the pit lane and qualifying or something. Or then I look at the numbers. So I tend to use the numbers a lot.
Isn't that so interesting? And I think about it from like an Alex Jake standpoint on F1 TV and how quickly he can call what's happening, especially out of turn one, right? And all of a sudden he can differentiate two cars who look very similar, and it's not probably by the black or the yellow. It's probably not, you know, who knows his little magic sauce differentiating between them. My question is to bounce off of driver one and driver two. We've talked with Bottas and Zhou about who picks what side of the garage and if driver one gets preferential treatment here to there. When someone's a driver one, from your guys' experiences, do you find that driver one sticks with them? In other cases, it becomes like their tag.
Well, I can answer that one specifically because I was the one that did it for Joe and for Valtteri in terms of picking. So for us, it was, you know, Valtteri had got his contract signed before and, you know, he was kind of coming in as a senior driver. Joe was the rookie. I was, you know, I wondered if maybe, so we also have colours. So a lot of the time you don't tend to use driver one and driver two because internally it's just a bit mean, you know, like within the teams, we tend to use colours and they're typically like opposite of the colour wheel. So red and blue or red and green. Mercedes had red and blue for years and years and years. Some people do get very protective over their colors. So the story at Mercedes goes is that when, you know, based on the fact that it was Michael and then Nico and then Lewis, Lewis was blue because Nico had red, but Lewis really wanted red. So when Nico retired, Lewis got red. So that meant that when Valtteri came in, he was blue. So I asked him saying, would you like to be red now? You know, like, have you always had a burning desire to be like red is a better color? And he's like, no, I like blue. And then the same thing with the left and the right. You know, I said, oh, you know, would you like to be the other side? That again, it depends. Some tracks, one of the sides is harder to get out than the other if you're further down the pit lane. But the sides of the garage, again, it's just like, you know, personal preference, you know, just like fashion choice, I guess. And yeah, no, he actually chose the exact same combo that he had inherited in Mercedes. So his favorite color is blue. So that's why he was blue. And actually Joe didn't get shoes, but he wanted red because he's the first Chinese driver and red is obviously their national colors and is a lucky color in China. So that one worked out great. But yeah, as Bernie says, it used to be pre-2014, we used to have a kind of yellow, and actually it was red actually back in the day. The flash is based on the championship order from the previous year, but now I think it's a lot more based on it. And yeah, as Bernie says, the Lewis one, he was car one officially, which was the black flash for years and years and years, and then when he moved from the purple to the lime green, it was deemed too difficult and too easy to make a mistake if you've got two colours that are very, very similar operating together. Because years ago, back in 2009, when they were Braun, in the Silverstone Grand Prix, they both turned up with special helmets. And Rubens Barrichello and Jenson Button both turned up with lime coloured helmets, which apparently made the whole race weekend an absolute nightmare because nobody knew who was who coming in. So the flashes were actually quite important because of the helmets having normally been completely different, because Jensen's was normally like a British flag and Barrichello's was like a neon one. They both turned up with similar colours. So unlike Bernie, I actually did use the flashes because I have very poor eyesight. So I'm the world's worst tire spotter. We used to have a light pink that was the softest tire. It was called a Hypersoft, and a white one, which was almost the hardest tire. And I would routinely get them confused when we were tire spotting in winter testing, when we used to not get the tires to on the feed. So if there was any kind of strategic prowess that involved eyesight, I would be deadpan lost and go back to our failure question. So I had to revise before the start of every season, or if we have driver swaps, and I did it on the flash because I couldn't see. I get like a Williams, an old school Williams, confused with my own car. So like I definitely had to learn the flashes because I'm blind as a bat.
Well, nowadays it's black or yellow. So I've got another quiz you'll be glad to know. This quiz is named after Wiz Khalifa's timeless 2011 classic, Black and Yellow. It's called Black or Yellow. So, Bernie, do you happen to know whether Carlos Sainz was black or yellow for his T-bar?
He's yellow.
Ruth?
He picked yellow, didn't he? Because he liked the neon. Yes, it was him, Alonso. Him and Alonso and Lewis were the ones that picked the yellow because they loved the vibes.
Well, Katie, I'll leave it to you to do the pressure questions.
Yeah, here's the pressure one. Bernie Collins, your former driver, Lance Stroll.
Oh, we've just done Alonso.
Oh, sorry.
So, or he's just done the answer for that.
You can do the next one. You can do. I'll answer that one. You can do the next one.
Ruth, you've ruined the format. Oh, gosh, you guys. For goodness sake.
Here's the thing. I was still surprised with it because I didn't put two and two together.
I didn't as well. We're not strategists, clearly, are we, Katie?
Do you want me just to say black? I'll take the point. I just feel like I'm cheating. Take the point. Black.
Celebrate because everyone else did not finish the race. You get the point because we just didn't finish. So, and then Ruth, your forward driver, Joe.
Oh yeah, Joe was a yellow.
Well, she's already said she made the decision.
Because I did it. So I had to fill the form in. So if I got that one wrong, I'd have been really embarrassing.
Christian and I are definitely not strategists. Sorry. For that reason, we did not connect the dots. That's appropriately under pressure for the quiz game. So
that completely ruins the game, and that's the end of the episode. Goodbye. So what we've learnt is questions into the break might come back, but black or yellow definitely won't. That was a resounding failure, unfortunately.
I could have asked you, Christian. I feel like rather than asking us, it would have been more.
Yeah, that would have been better, wouldn't it? We'll do that next time.
That would have been, yeah.
And on that slightly disappointing note, that's the end of the episode. Other than the quiz, Bernie and Ruth, have you enjoyed yourselves?
Always.
Yeah, I enjoyed the quiz. It was good.
Who won the quiz?
Equal.
I think Ruth won.
Share the podium. I think Ruth
definitely won.
Oh, but you got 2/10 for your accent. So actually, you're back in front.
That's not on me. That's just an inherited.
Sometimes it's nature versus nurture. And sometimes you got to appreciate what you were given.
Yeah. In F2, they have three colors. So they have a red, a yellow and a black. And that is very, very useful for spotting.
Yeah, but that's very confusing for a quiz format.
Well, on that note, ladies, Christian, Chris, everybody who's joined us here for the second rapid fire with Ruth and Bernie, we thank you guys. That was a blast. You guys are fun.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun. We hope you both come back soon. And if you would like to know a little bit more about the scheme Ruth mentioned earlier, if you're looking for a head start into motorsport, just search for Formula Student online. And F1 Explained at F1.com is the email address to send us your questions or voice notes that we'll put to an expert from the world of Formula One.
Yeah, we really appreciate you listening. We're back every Friday of the Formula One season, and looking forward to more with you and Christian and everybody else. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.